Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. More than 3,000 years ago, Egypt was ruled by a powerful female pharaoh. Hatshepsut was not the first woman to rule ancient Egypt, but she was unusual for the scale of her power, for the way she adopted royal male gear and iconography right down to the fake beard of pharaohs, and for the way her stepson's successor struck her name from every monument he could lay his hands on. This hour, On Point, an old mummy, modern DNA, and new light on Egypt's pharaoh queen. You can join the conversation. How far do you think we can really understand what went on in one grand life in ancient Egypt 3,500 years ago? We will hear in this hour from the Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council for Antiquities. But joining me first from New York is author Chip Brown. His cover story in the current issue of National Geographic is headlined, "The She King of Egypt." Chip Brown, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
You were there in the Cairo Museum with the very mummy that it's now believed to be Hatshepsut. What did it look like? What can you relate to in a mummy 3,500 years old?
She's a pretty nasty piece of work as she exists in her actual corpus now, but that's to be expected. I'm sure she looks a lot better than any of us will in 3,500 years.
You write that her fingertips caught you somehow.
Yeah, I thought they were fingernails at first. I could have sworn they were fingernails, but the National Geographic is probably the most rigorous fact-checking left in the commercial magazine business, and eventually we came to realize that they were the flange tips of her finger bones, and they happened to look like nails because of the way the skin shrinks back, and it creates these beautiful, elongated, perfect manicure-like look, and it's the envy of many nail salons. And they were very they were touching to me, and figuratively they were touching because nothing else. They were they seemed like the last vestige of her humanity, the part that she would have touched her daughter Neferure or. Written something, or handled a leopard skin, or lifted a leaf of a myrrh tree to her nose, and the rest of her was this sort of horrific mask of mummified flesh, and her ear was sort of sunk into the side of her head. There was no hair on her head except for some tiny hairs at the back that you can't see. Her nose was gone. It was stuffed with tightly round rolls of linen, and the most horrific thing of all, it's not really horrific, but just sort of ghastly, was her eye sockets were filled with this black resin, and you just to stare at her was to stare at this thing that was so ancient, it was and so dead, and you realize what struck me was how much of her is alive in her texts. And her texts exist because they were carved in stone and on temple walls and on obelisks. Some of the largest obelisks left in Egypt were erected by Hatshepsut.
You know, but I'm looking at this in the photographs here in the National Geographic side by side. Horrible in a way, but as you say, she looks a lot better than any of us will look in 3,500 years. But just behind her great, I'm not sure what to call it, temple at Deir al-Bahri?
Deir al-Bahri, yeah, that's her
mortuary
temple.
Unbelievable. This is hundreds of miles south on the Nile, across from the river from Luxor, Valley of Kings, and this queen. And it is absolutely stunning structure.
Well, it's been rebuilt by the Polish Egyptian archaeology task force, or that's been there since 1960s, when it was. So some pictures of it in the 50s, and it's quite a ruin. There was a monastery built on it. Deir al-Bahri, I think, means northern monastery. It was basically buried in rubble, and it's been excavated and reconstructed, and now it looks, somewhat almost like it did in the time, except there are no beautiful shade trees are missing, and there used to be beautiful long reflecting pools.
Red rock all around.
Idyllic spots in the whole valley.
We're going to hear in just a few minutes from the famous archaeologist and Egyptologist, Egyptian Zahi Hawass. But tell us the story here of Hatshepsut. Give us the basics so that we can begin to understand the significance of the archaeology and DNA work that's gone on recently. How did it come to be that she was the she-king, as your magazine puts it, of Egypt? And what did that mean? And what's the record?
Well, she was pressed into service as the regent for a young king, as is often the case. The previous king, she's descended from what they call the Thutmose line of the ancient Egyptian kings. Mm-hmm. They believe her grandmother may be Amos Nefertari, who was married to Amos, who was the founder of the 18th dynasty. And this was really one of the most magnificent dynasties in the whole history of Egypt that expanded the imperial power of Egypt and initiated enormous building projects and brought great wealth and stability to Egypt in what they call the period of the New Kingdom, which began around 1600 BC or so. Mm-hmm. New Kingdom began 1539. Around then.
And these were great days. You described King Tut, who all Americans have heard about, as a pipsqueak of a king.
He was relatively... And you see the lavish splendor that he was left in, buried in, that survived down to our time. And you can only imagine the amount of gold and finery and provisions for the afterlife that would have been buried with someone like Hatshepsut or Ramesses or Thutmose I or Thutmose III. Thutmose III, who was the stepson of Hatshepsut, and it was with him that she was the co-regent for about 7 years. He was too young to assume the duties of the king, so she, as his aunt, essentially. Mm-hmm. The relations are extremely complicated because they're always marrying their sisters and
brother sister marriages and all the rest. But he was he would have been the heir. He was too young. But it wasn't a quick handoff to him.
No. She could have stepped aside, but she didn't. And this gave rise to this whole to our modern interpretation that she was as the head of the Metropolitan Museum in the 1930s called her a vain, unscrupulous, ambitious woman, which was a sort of a sexist slander of her political skills. And when no one can know what the reason why she continued on is and why she assumed the throne, why she took the mantle of the kingship, took the iconography, took the duties of the king, but certainly she was she ruled for longer than any other woman in the history of Egypt. Her rule was extremely successful, so there must have been something right about what she was doing.
We know a fair bit from what's carved in stone and painted on stone about the way she presented herself to Egypt and the world, and it was significant in how people interpret her and her reign.
Yeah, she left factual records of what she did, and she also concocted stories, fables of her accession to the throne, things that couldn't have happened. Like she drew some on the temple at Deir al-Bari. There's the scenes in which Thutmose I is seen at her coronation when he was clearly had gone into the afterlife. So she was a propagandist, like all politicians.
And what about her gender depiction in these, Chip?
Well, she didn't hide the fact that she was a woman. I mean, the most significant thing about that is that she would use feminine endings in her texts. But she seemed to want to create some synthesis of the male and female role or some visual depiction that made it possible for people to accept a female as the pharaoh. And so she would present herself in what they call the striding pose, even though she was wearing a long a skirt that would have restricted her gait.
We've all seen that, the Egyptian pharaohs with that kind of long, regal stride.
Right, mm-hmm. And that was the male prerogative to be presented that way. The women always had their feet together or closer together.
And the fake beard, which we've often seen in depictions of pharaohs. I'm sorry, I don't want to miss your joke.
Oh, no, the joke was that that her skirt was made out of latex. That was an Egyptologist joke.
Very stretchy. And how about the fake beard? I presume fake on male pharaohs as well, that kind of long
Well, yes. It's, I think it's on the statues. It's made out of stone. I don't know actually what – they must have worn something in the ceremonies, and I don't know what that was made of. Zahi Hawass probably have a better sense of that. But
she was depicted with it, even though she had the breasts in the depiction and clearly a female.
Yes, there are different statues. Some statues are more male and some are more female. Some clearly show that she has a figure, a female figure. You know, and she's unmistakably depicted as a boy being born on the walls of Deir al-Bari on one of the temple carvings. So she's presented to Amon as a little from the potter's wheel on the where she's made by God. She's presented as a boy, you know, complete with the male genitals. So that's quite cheeky, to say the least.
It puts her in the line of males because by the religion of that day, you write, the pharaoh was supposed to be male, but she somehow carved out literally a big exception to that.
Yeah, it probably has a lot to do with the difference between what any society's sort of official version of what's real and what's actually real. You know, there's always a sort of a gap or some sort of disjunction between what actually is going on and what is said to be going on. And the power is never quite what it seems, and it lies elsewhere. And so these are the guises of power. And the guises of authority were very important to the Egyptians, but the actual execution of power and authority were, you know, there was extremely powerful people behind the scenes. Mm. The chief priest of Amun, the temples had a power that rivaled the king's power.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Pharaoh Queen, the She King of Egypt, Hatshepsut, and the still unfolding story of her remarkable reign 3,500 years ago. We've been joined from New York City by Chip Brown, author of the big National Geographic cover story, The She King of Egypt. Remarkable story, remarkable photographs, really something to see. We're joined right now, and very happy to be so, from Cairo, Egypt, by world-renowned archaeologist and Egyptologist Zahi Hawass. He is Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities. He led the effort that positively identified the mummy of Queen Hatshepsut in 2007. He's been right in the thick of all of this. Zahi Hawass, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us the story of how a single tooth led you to identify, at least as we can so far, a kind of ignored mummy as the mummy of this queen?
You know, that tooth is maybe the end of the story, but the beginning of the story that it took us almost 1 year. It's the Egyptian mummy process, which I'm heading. We began to reveal the secrets of many mummies. Actually, we started with King Tut, and we found out how King Tut died, actually. And the second project that we are doing right now is to identify the family of King Tut, his mother and father, and to know everything about this family. And when I did Queen Hatshepsut, I never thought at all that I will discover this mummy. But I began to collect all the mummies in Cairo Museum and in the Valley of the King, especially any mummy that the left arm is on the chest and the right arm is on the side.
Kind of royal pose.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And but first, before I began to study those, I began to find out about her father, Thutmose the First, who have his mummy. And the most amazing thing that we found out that the mummy labeled now in the carriage
Oh, our line to Cairo is rough. Chip, I'm going to have to ask you to step in here. We'll try and get a better line to Zahi Hawass in Cairo. It's so great to have him.
One
but
of the things
that
he was saying was they discovered that the mummy they thought was Thutmose the first in the royal mummy rooms, mm-hmm. lying in splendor and gawked at by millions of visitors, is not Thutmose the first at all. He is somebody else, and they have to now go find where Thutmose the first is. And they were able to do this through CAT scans that they did, and they found out he wasn't they found out that he had died in a different fashion than he was known to have died in or something.
But there was a single tooth in the belongings of Hatshepsut, I guess everybody knew that her mummy wasn't in her royal tomb room. It had
been
moved.
Her sarcophagi, where three of them were empty.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great cache of mummies found in 1881 in called the Deir el-Bari cache, which mm-hmm. is not that far from where Hatshepsut's temple is, and it is the greatest hoard of ancient mummies ever found. It had been pilfered for a number of years beforehand by local grave robbers who were selling off the artifacts, and it was eventually taken over by the Egyptian government, brought to Cairo, and that's where most of the mummies in the Royal Mummy Room are from.
Mm-hmm.
In among that cache was a small wooden box, either a box that could be used for jewelry or to store oils, or to store some sort of trinkets. Not a canopic jar, not a box that you would normally, not a marble alabaster type container that you would normally put the organs in during
mm-hmm.
mummification.
Mm-hmm.
But in this box, there was a petrified organ. Actually, it was part of a stomach and a spleen. And you couldn't open the top of the box without destroying it because the petrified organ was literally like
adhered.
Rock.
Adhered. Mm-hmm.
Right. And on the box was the cartouche, which is the hieroglyphic symbol of Hatshepsut and her throne name, which is Matkare. So they knew that this box was connected to Hatshepsut. However, the lid was ajar, and this mm-hmm. organ was spilling half out of it. Not spilling; it was like a piece of lava mm-hmm. that was frozen. So they are CAT scanning all these mummies, and they've discovered that the mummy Hatshepsut, who was then called KV-60A, that was her name,
just a number, an ID number,
just a number. Mm-hmm. They discovered that she has bone cancer and an abscessed tooth, probably die of an infection, probably couldn't walk in her last years, probably was in her mid-50s, which was old for ancient Egypt.
Wait, all this from the organ
from
spilling
the CAT
out
scan.
Beneath the cartouche or from the mummy?
No, from the CAT scan. This was from the CAT scan of the body.
Uh-huh,
but they didn't have the body.
Eightfold
didn't
mummy,
have a,
unidentified as her.
Right,
as her.
Okay. An unidentified body. The body mm-hmm. didn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
There was no wrapping. There was none of the wrappings on the raveled linen wrappings that the mummy was wrapped in
mm-hmm.
contained any cartouche or any kind of
royal sign.
Sign mm-hmm. of who she was. So they have this body. And Zahi, who's on the phone over there, I guess.
We're trying.
Trying. Sounds like a car phone.
Yeah.
Says, let's run the box through the CAT scan machine. It's sort of a, okay. And lo and behold, they look at this box, and buried between the side of the box and the organ, in a place completely unseen since 1881 and probably since the time it was put into the box, which would be 3,500 years ago, is a tooth. They measure the tooth. They go back to look at all the mummies, the four mummies that they've been reviewing as part of this mummy project,
mm-hmm.
and they discover that there is a molar. It's the root of a tooth, and they discover that there's a exact space for the same tooth in the upper, I think it's the upper right-hand part of this mummy's jaw that was known as KV-60A.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just, it's not conclusive proof because there's it assumes that the tooth in the box was put there at the time, but why would they put an organ in a box? There's some mystery about that. Why would you put a canopic jar type organ into a wooden box? However, The chances.
But this is the point at which you write it becomes more CSI than Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, the odds that this tooth would even exist is so phenomenal, and the tooth would exactly match a gap in a mummy's smile is astonishing, and the fact that it would survive, that the tooth would take 3,500 years for the tooth to come back to the mummy, and then to make this identification of a pharaoh who was so notable, so significant in the history of Egypt, a mummy that, by the way, lay kind of neglected and ignored for at least 100 years in the Valley of the Kings. And then when they realized who she was, they would have qualms about taking the glass panel off to photograph her.
Yeah.
She couldn't get arrested for 100 years, and now she's the center of attention.
I hope we have Zahi Hawass back in Cairo. Mr. Hawass, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I wonder if you could give us some of your interpretation. Chip Brown has been good enough to tell us a bit about how this was found and how the discovery that you led there.
I don't think you're back, because the Egyptian mummy process, we are the one who found this mummy, and I can tell you, I told you, I'm trying to tell you the story. The story that gets to
we dearly want to hear exactly that story, but alas, our phone line is just too rough to capture your voice, Zahi Hawass, in Cairo, and I am sorry for that. The Secretary General of Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities. That's too bad. But there it is, halfway around the world. What are you going to do? Chip, begin to tie this in then to the story of this relationship and why. You say that she was kind of slandered as this conniving queen, mother of the guy who struck all of the representations off so many monuments. But why would a stepson have gone out years later and had his servants chisel her name away?
Well, the initial assumption was that they had been chiseled away right away, and that's where the story of the stepson wreaking vengeance on the stepmother who denied him the throne when he was chafing for it. That's how that got started. However, they discovered, around in 1960, that this effacement of her images and her the pictures of her as the king in the male guise had taken place 20 years after her death. And so that ended the whole idea of this being a hot-blooded, impulsive act of vengeance, and has sort of led to speculation, because that's all it really is what would cause Thutmose III, who, by the way, is considered the Napoleon of ancient Egypt, as some of his battles are still taught today at the West Point Military Academy.
17 military campaigns in 19 years, particularly into the area of Israel and Lebanon today.
Right. Megiddo, the Battle of Megiddo, is still taught where he took a third difficult route and snuck up on, I guess it was the Canaanites, and he, as they say, smited them.
so he could have, he was no shrinking violet, and yet he waited 20 years. On the other hand, he had them all smitten from these monuments.
His stepmom's monuments as thoroughly as he had done the Canaanites. And the only thing that makes sense is that he was trying to reinforce the royal line of succession for his son, who was called Amenhotep II. And there probably might have been a rival line that came through Hatshepsut, because Thutmose III was descended from Thutmose II, who was descended from Thutmose I. Thutmose I was not of royal blood. He was a general who was married into what they call the Amos Nefertari Amos line, the Amoside line. Mm-hmm. And Hatshepsut was directly descended from, they believe, she was descended from the Amoside line. So she was a blue blood, and Thutmose I, her father, who was a general who married into that line. Thutmose II was not born out of the Amosite line either. He was the product of a second wife that Thutmose I had. So Thutmose II, who Hatshepsut eventually married in this brother sister marriage, they produced Thutmose. They did not produce a son. They produced a daughter, and Neferure, who also seems to vanish shortly after Hatshepsut dies. Or at least in the records. And so the Thutmose III, it comes from a second wife of Thutmose II. I know this is incredibly complicated.
It's pretty hard to figure out.
The point is that the line of succession was had much less claim to royal divinity than the line of through Thutmose III than it did through Hatshepsut. So if there were people for like Neferure or anyone that was somehow more directly related to Hatshepsut than they were to Thutmose III, they might have had some kind of rival claim to the throne. So I think the theory is that he would have been quick to remove any trace of his mother, his stepmother, in a royal capacity, a male pharaoh capacity.
Hoping to put her away. Now, she was the blue blood then, but you write that there are many references in the record that she does leave to the common people, almost an unusual outreach for a pharaoh, a great king, to the common people of Egypt. What was that about you?
Yeah, that's an interesting researcher at Wales who had gone through the hieroglyphic texts that are all in, I guess they were all collected by the Germans in the 19th century. And he noticed a very frequent use of the word rec, which I don't know that's actually if that's how you pronounce it. There are no vowel sounds in hieroglyphics, so the vowels are sort of imposed for our convenience. Mm-hmm. But he noticed that this word rec appeared often, and the rec is depicted as a lapwing bird, and it's used to mean the common people, the everyday people of Egypt. And he noticed that Hatshepsut was always sort of speaking to the rec and in her texts and referring to my rec. And I think the surmise is that she had a kind of a streak of populism in her that probably helped buttress her legitimacy and her authority. And she was liked by the people. I'm not sure, but she certainly made an appeal to them often in texts more frequently than other pharaonic hieroglyphic records indicate, according to this PhD candidate at Swansea University. It's just an interesting wrinkle in her political relations with her subjects.
But as you say, in the great age of what we think of as Egyptian exploration, the whole sort of, I mean, it's all fiction, but the Indiana Jones era, when 1903, 1881, people were really diving in here, there was a very quick assumption that this was the vain, unscrupulous, conniving female who held the young man from his throne.
Right.
It was almost an instant interpretation.
History is written according to the prejudices of the people who write it. And Egyptology was dominated by men. And in the 30s, I don't think you found a lot of sensitivity toward women's political or social roles. I mean, there was the chauvinism of the male was sort of paramount in those times. And this was William C. Hayes, the curator of Egyptian art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and who was a principal at the Deir al-Bari excavations in the 20s and 30s, I've heard he was quite sexist in his behavior, but I mean, I don't know. He wrote that he kind of treated Hatshepsut as a bounder, I guess, an interloper who was sort of conniving and to take over a male power.
And there she was at the height of ancient Egyptian power, though. And this was a woman. She went to war herself.
She did go to war, not as vigorous, not as frequently or as often. And I'm not sure. There's too much known about her campaigns, although there were some. But she kept things. Certainly, she kept the country running on a steady pace. She didn't screw things up, and that's, as we can see, is a huge political achievement.
All in itself.
Yeah.
And she built, obelisks and temples and monuments all over the place. There's no shortage.
And the most amazing thing I saw in Egypt, and I guess everyone who's been to Aswan knows about this, is the quarry of the unfinished obelisk. There's some sense that that was either Hatshepsut or Thutmose III. There's no way of knowing whose it was. But this was an obelisk that was over 1,000 tons. And the largest obelisk in Egypt is Hatshepsut, and it weighs, I think, something like 350 tons. So this was an order of magnitude larger. And this was being quarried out of the rock by thousands of workers pounding diorite, pounding stones on granite.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the pharaoh, queen, the she-king of Egypt, Hatshepsut, and the still unfolding story of her reign. Chip Brown is with us from New York. He's got the great cover story in the National Geographic, The She-King of Egypt. Amazing photographs and really an amazing story of a woman of royal blood who stepped in when her stepson was too young and took power and held power for a long, long time. He struck her name from the monuments once he had taken power. Let's go to Suzanne in Northampton, Massachusetts. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if, I believe Hatshepsut ruled possibly 1,500 years before Cleopatra or...
Roughly, yeah.
Around that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was wondering if Cleopatra would have known if there had been so much eradicated that Cleopatra might not have known about Hatshepsut's rule and if it informed her rule in any way.
That's interesting. Chip, what do you
That's
know? Could she have
question.
Claimed, you
Actually,
know...
That is a good question. I don't... she may not have known about Cleopatra. Cleopatra may not have known about Hatshepsut's rule. There were royal records and king records that she might have known about, and Hatshepsut was eliminated, struck from those records also. So I think it was really archaeology that brought Hatshepsut back to life. Even some of her temples were re-engraved, if not by her stepson, by Ramesses II would re-engrave people's, he would re-engrave anything, apparently. But Cleopatra might have known about some queens, but I don't know this for a fact. Plutarch doesn't mention anything about it. What she knew about Hatshepsut is probably hard to say. I would doubt it very much. However, Cleopatra did not rule she did not take the male guise when she was the queen of Egypt.
She's called Pharaoh in the records, I see.
She's Pharaoh,
not with the whole regalia.
By then, the Egyptian Empire was in its last days. She was the last pharaoh of Egypt, but she ruled as a queen. She did not present herself in the male guise. She tried to, and she was probably a Macedonian, and from a Greek lineage. Mm-hmm. So she took on a lot of. She tried to take on some of the assume some of the Egyptian religious rites, and she made an effort to kind of. Speak to the religious beliefs of her subjects, but she was essentially an outsider.
Chip, I don't expect you to be an expert on all of these, but I'm thinking of other royal names in ancient Egypt, female, and Nefertiti comes to mind. She was much closer to Hatshepsut's time.
Right. Yeah, she might have done. I mean, I don't know. I know a little bit about Cleopatra because I worked on a story about Cleopatra, but there are. I think there are five queens that were ruled as pharaoh. The longest one before Hatshepsut was Sobekneferu, who ruled for about 5 years in 17 in the Middle Kingdom. Nefertiti was a queen, but married to Akhenaten, I think, right?
And tell us about if so much was smitten from the stone records, what did remain when of Hatshepsut? I mean, what is the archaeological record?
Some of the things that remained were remained through flu. Thutmose III took one of the great once you got an obelisk into place at the Temple of the Temple of Amon at Karnak, it was very hard to get it to move it anywhere because it weighed 350 tons. And it's hard to efface those because the carvings were so deep in the obelisks, unlike, say, the wall of a temple. So what he did was, what Thutmose III did was had the obelisk covered up and walled up, like just bricked over, essentially. And what that had the effect of doing, which was preserving the carvings underneath in immaculate condition. And when the day came many thousands of years later that the bricks were removed, there was the record of his stepmother in pristine condition.
Thanks to him.
Yes, thanks to him. He ended up preserving her. And by the way, he did not erase all of her iconography, only the iconography in which she depicted herself as a male. So wherever she's depicted as queen or as God's wife of Amun or one of her many, many titles, those survived. So it's not like she was erased from the historical record. What was
interesting,
what was effaced was the record of her ruling as in the male capacity of pharaoh. So that's
wow. I mean, that opens up room for all kinds of further speculation, doesn't it?
That's,
I mean,
right.
Would it have only been the male representations that would have suggested her line somehow, or could it be that something had fallen out of favor with her experiment in a woman presenting herself as a male?
Well, that's why this idea that he was shoring up his own lineage makes sense. And by the way, he did not, you know, she did not shoulder him aside and say you can't. They ruled as they ruled together. They're often depicted as there's two pharaohs. It's like having two stars in the sky. They're often standing side by side each other, but she's usually in the power position during the 21 years of her reign. Which is usually the front position.
Let's go to Marge in East Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Marge. You're on the air.
Yes. I personally met in the 1950s a graduate from the Northwestern Institute of Egyptology who had done a dissertation on the cartouches that held the queen's names. She read the actual hieroglyphics. Mm-hmm. And wrote her dissertation. Their name was Barbara Mertz, M-E-R-T-Z, and she's published profusely.
And what's the point you took from her here, Marge?
Well, that she had a PhD on, she could read hieroglyphics, and she had her PhD on the queens.
Yeah.
In hieroglyphics.
So?
Well, she studied the whole thing.
Well, that's good. A lot of people have, and it's good that she has as well. Let me another call right here from Naples, Florida. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi. Just about a week ago, I finished reading a book called Black Women in Antiquity, edited by Ivan Van Sertima, and he has quite a few of the rulers, of female rulers in Egypt. And one was the one that you're speaking about now. And I just wanted to let you know that at the time of this writing, which was in 1988-89, they had not found her mummified remains. And I'm glad that you're elaborating a little bit more on her history and things that were not known at that time. I am so thankful, and I'm very glad to hear that she has been found.
That's great. Barbara raises an interesting question here, Chip, and I don't know if identifying a mummy goes to this issue of race, which has had a lot of attention in recent years, around who were the leaders of ancient Egypt and what was the racial factor here. Does that come through in the examination of a mummy, or is it something
I don't. Mummies sort of look like mummies to me, but I don't know what. I've never seen a person who I knew what their race was, and then they were turned into a mummy, so I could say, "Oh, it's obvious that." But I just don't know.
And what I'm looking at here is skin. If that's what we're talking about, skin is not exactly the first the prize element of a mummy. It's
No, well, there's skin. It's really leather. It's kind of it's a form of tanning, I think. It's a drying process, and there is a surprisingly. I mean, it's not like you're looking at a skeleton. You're actually looking at what was skin. It's just been dried to the point of petrification. You know, it's been turned into almost a. It's like leather, I think.
Speaking of things that are dried, I'm also reading here that there's a university in Germany that found residue in these remains that maybe we're talking about beneath the cartouche here of what appeared to be her perfume. And they're trying to recreate that, bottle it, and maybe sell it.
Myrrh. Well, it's probably based on myrrh, which was the plant she brought back from the mythical land, not mythical, the land, the obscure land of Punt, which is maybe somewhere near where all those pirates are operating now.
In Somalia area.
Yeah. So, but it was once a fabulously wealthy land, and there's a picture, there's a diagram in the Geographic showing the processions, which that diagram is based on the temple, the sketches that are literally drawn in the stone on her temple that are very faint, but if you really study them closely in the right light, you see the whole Punt expedition recounted as a kind of a biography. It's almost like a diary of a great adventure. There's people setting off onto the ship, bringing back the trees, and to this day, there are still the roots of the myrrh trees that were planted by Hatshepsut at Deir el-Bari. All that exists are the stumps that they're surrounded in the little holes. But there they are, 3,500 years later.
Let me take a call from Quebec, Sutton, Quebec. Eddie, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm just calling to find out about whether he knows anything about the when she went into the land of Punt, and because Punt is it's still a questionable place.
That's just what we were talking about.
Right. So supposedly, the Horn of Africa, Somalia area. I mean, I'm reading here, Chip, that she launched was said to launch a naval caravan there and brought back ships, heavy with myrrh and frankincense and these.
Right. Myrrh trees. She brought back leopard skins. I don't think she went. Maybe she
launched
may have sent
it,
an expedition that brought back all these goods. I don't know that she didn't go for a fact, but it's probably something she dispatched and imported all the stuff back.
The interpretation that I read was saying that that this kind of incense and perfume was so rare in those days, it itself was associated with the royal line. And having it and wearing it may have been a way of asserting her royal status.
That's true. I mean, and trees were rare, and gold was rare, and copper was so valuable that one measure of the wealth of the regime was that when they did use copper chisels, the copper would wear down the chisels. It was sort of be like hunting with gold bullets. To carve with the copper. The copper was incredibly expensive. That's why making those obelisks, as I was saying before, is so phenomenal. They pounded the rock, they heated the rock and tried to crack it by hot water, and then would be hitting it with using sometimes copper chisels, which really aren't too effective in granite. The amount of treasure that went into creating these monuments was just phenomenal.
Let's get a call from New Haven, Connecticut, and Richard. Richard, you're on the air.
Yes, I am a retired physician, and a colleague at Yale has presented a talk showing that there is evidence of an enzyme deficiency in some of the pharaohs that made them look like females when they're actually male, called aromatase, which would break down the naturally formed estrogen of a male, which is minimal in quality, but was deficient. So the estrogen gave external characteristics of a female in what is a male.
And wow, that's fascinating.
I don't know if your experts there are aware of any of that scientific information.
Richard, what are you thinking with that? Are you doubting that she was actually a female? Maybe she was just a very feminine
exactly.
Male?
No, I don't think there's any. I think they've looked at this from the bone scans. They can tell by the way her hips are set, and I don't think there's any doubt about her sex at all. There may be effeminate pharaohs based on nutritional problems, but
fascinating.
There certainly
though.
were powerful female queens, and there's no doubt that she was a woman. I mean, the CT scans can tell you enough to tell you how she died, even, and she had the skeletal conformation of a woman.
But in this elaborate game of trying to project our minds back 3,500 years and imagine what these stone signals and DNA tell us, if there was some breakdown of estrogen, what eating chemicals in the male pharaohs, if there were gender representation issues there, maybe more sensitivity there.
That's an interesting idea. I'd love to see that paper. But you know, the ancient DNA is extremely fragile, and I'm not sure what kind of chemical assays are can be done on mummified flesh. I mean, what sort of chemical integrity it has that would reflect the condition of the specimen at the time of its death, because probably the organic, the biological components would probably break down over the centuries and disappear. As it is, when they get samples, they can't even sample the flesh of the mummies. It just doesn't work. As I understand it, what they're mostly trying to get samples from the iliac crest. They try to get bone DNA. And when you're doing ancient mummy DNA work, a robust sample would be considered 500 base pairs, which is tiny and almost part of the protocol now means you have to do it at least twice because the sample size is so small. Whereas I guess from what I understand in forensic DNA and of today, you have thousands and thousands of base pairs to make your comparisons for relations, to establish relations between fathers and sons and daughters and whatnot.
Chip, we're almost out of time here. Just got half a minute. But how did you come away in all this thinking about?
Well, you wonder why, what it is that we want. I mean, a couple of things. We know more about, despite all of the enormous obscurity of ancient Egypt, I probably know more about Hatshepsut than I do my great-great-grandfather, because she did write in stone and because she did leave these stone legacies and because she was so conscious of making a record for the afterlife that I was just overawed by the immensity and the magnificence of the Egyptian civilization.
Well, all these thousands of years later, even popular culture is still inspired by it. Chip Brown with the National Geographic. The big cover story is the She King of Egypt. Chip, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Great having you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Egyptian.